Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it mean to be black or white in America, and how porous is the line between the two races? For more than a century, we have understood intellectually that race is a social construct rather than a set of immutable characteristics. Yet long after the abolition of slavery, many Americans have also understood that whiteness carried with it certain protections and privileges not afforded to their black neighbors. And over the years, some African-American families have transformed themselves into white families, with each generation trading their histories and identities for the perceived benefits of whiteness. Daniel J. Sharfstein is Associate Professor of Law at Vanderbilt University. He explores how and why some families have made such transitions in his new book, The Invisible Line, Three American Families and the Secret Journey from Black to White. Daniel, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
This book is such a reminder that that line between black and white has always been porous throughout our country's history. Why have we always tended to see it as immutable?
That's a great question. I think a big reason for that, we have to look at the beginning of American history, that the line between black and white mattered a lot less than the line between slave and free. So in a lot of the court decisions and policies of legislatures and just people's daily thoughts, what they were thinking about when they thought about race every day, really revolved around preserving the institution of slavery and the narrative that it was impossible for an African American to become white, that this was a dividing line that couldn't be crossed, was a very attractive one.
What's interesting, too, is that in our very earliest history, we didn't have lifelong slavery for European Americans, but there was indentured servitude, which in many cases amounted to something very similar.
Yes, and even for the first generation of African Americans in the New World, the English had very little experience with slavery. The tobacco crop, it was entirely unclear whether it would be a success, and there were these huge booms and busts. And there was a lot of leverage for the first African Americans to negotiate their way out of slavery or to negotiate very different terms for themselves than what we would normally associate with slavery. And at the same time, there were plenty of opportunities for African Americans to have relationships with the English. People in Virginia, especially in the early decades, the landowners and the indentured servants and the slaves were essentially working shoulder to shoulder.
But I guess over time, in areas where some people did have slaves, it was very hard to have your next-door neighbor be African-American and treat that person as an equal and then justify keeping other people in slavery.
That's absolutely true. And in a way, that's one of the reasons why courts were often very willing to hold that people were white even when there was evidence that they had some kind of ambiguous ancestry. This was to draw the color line too closely, to police it in too zealous a way, would mean that these kinds of unsettling reminders that it was not God's plan to keep people enslaved, that would be too much and really destabilizing to the slavery regime.
Reading through the book, it was hard to get my mind around some of the Byzantine systems by which different states and regions defined what it meant to be black. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Every state, the one-drop rule was a set of laws that did not become part of our legal regime until the 20th century. And before that, every state had their own set of laws. So in a lot of states, there was something known as a one-quarter rule. If a person had an African-American grandparent, then they were legally black. But anyone who had more remote African-American ancestry was legally white. A lot of other states had one-eighth rules. There were some states like South Carolina, which never had a legal definition of who was black and who was white in the antebellum era. And instead, you have court opinions where judges who were incredibly public, vocal defenders of slavery would say someone who is a respected member of the community and is a person of worth, that person should be white, and someone with exactly the same degree of blood who is not as socially prominent should be black. They had no problem with that. So in a way, someone who was African-American in North Carolina could just drive a few miles across the border and find themselves white.
So essentially, throughout our history, classification as black functioned as a sort of ipso facto justification for discrimination. That's all it was.
That's basically right. The in a way, you try to look at these issues and you see that race has never really been about blood, because plenty of whites, millions even, have black blood. They're not passing. They're just white. And I think it really, the person who really had the keenest insight into this, I believe, was the African-American scholar W.E.B. Du Bois. And what he said was, people ask me, what is a black man? And I tell them, that's easy. The black man's the person who has to ride the Jim Crow car through Georgia.
You know, we've heard stories throughout the years of individual African Americans finding ways, as you mentioned this term, to pass for white over time. But in those cases, a lot of those stories were about people who moved away from their family and their friends, and they sort of started over in a place where people were unlikely to suspect their heritage. That was not the way it happened for the families that you profile in the book.
Well, there was an incredible diversity of ways that people could become white. And one thing that I found as I researched more and more of these families was that it was entirely possible to change your racial status but stay exactly where you were living, exactly where your family had lived for generations. And in a way, the world would change around these families. White communities were very capable, even at the worst times in the history of race relations, of thinking about race in very pragmatic ways on an individual level. And they were very capable of shaping the law of race to fit the realities of their everyday lives. So they could see past race and accept their friends, their neighbors, their spouses, their lovers, even when they knew that they had some kind of racially ambiguous ancestry. And I think the important thing is that these communities were not, we can't really think of them as islands of racial tolerance. At the same time that they were doing this, they could also be stalwart supporters of slavery and segregation and the idea of white supremacy. In a way, American communities all over the country were capable of thinking about race in a pragmatic and humane way. But on a larger level, they chose to hate.
Was it just not something they thought about? The incredible, I mean, it's so ironic that they could accept one person and not another and not think of themselves as bad people.
In a way, people live with intense contradictions all the time. And it's very easy to think, to distinguish individuals from larger social trends, especially when the larger social issues really are fictions. But even if people were conscious of their friends and neighbors' racial backgrounds, and there's reason to believe that they were, periodically there was always someone who would get mad and remind everybody, but then the issues would go right back under the surface. So even if people could think about race and see past it, there was always this risk of government scrutiny and reclassification. And in a way, the best way to ensure that no one would be reclassified was to toe the line publicly in regard to the hardline politics of race in America.
So let's talk about the Gibsons. They were living as free people of color as early as the late 1600s, moved to South Carolina in the 1730s, and because they gained wealth as planters, they were sort of viewed outside any constraints of race. They weren't seen as black and they weren't seen as white. They were planters.
Right. When they first moved to Mississippi in the when they first moved to South Carolina in the 1730s, the state legislature, they debated, or the colonial legislature debated whether they should be allowed to stay in the colony, because there was a widespread fear that they were in South Carolina to foment a massive slave revolt. And this was a big deal in South Carolina because South Carolina was majority slave at the time. And the governor of the colony had a personal audience with the family. And what he saw was they were skilled tradesmen. They had owned land in North Carolina and Virginia. And they had owned slaves. And there was such a need in South Carolina for people to settle the backcountry, which was this buffer zone between the plantations on the coast and Indian country in the interior, that he was able to say they are not Negroes nor slaves, but free people. And he granted them hundreds of acres of land. Once they were in the backcountry, the exigencies of everyday life, the need to turn the wilderness into farmland, the need to protect the communities from Native American attack, really trumped any niceties of the color line. So in the backcountry, it was the dividing lines were, in a way, they were beyond race, and the Gibsons were able to assimilate. And once they had assimilated, once they had married into the landowning families in the area, everyone had an incentive to circle the wagons when the Gibsons' race was questioned.
Is there any documentation that remains that explains whether or not the Gibsons felt guilty or conflicted about owning slaves themselves?
I think quite the contrary. I mean, there's no evidence suggesting that they had any feelings of guilt or remorse about owning slaves. And when they, in the 1760s, before the Revolution, they actually led a planter rebellion in the South Carolina backcountry, a movement that was known as the Regulators. And what the Regulators were essentially doing was policing the backcountry in the absence of much authority from the colonial government in Charleston. And policing the backcountry essentially meant attacking a lot of people of color who were living in the area. There is documentation of troops of regulators lynching African Americans, and the Gibsons were just part of that. And in a way, it only strengthened their claim to being white.
And Gideon Gibson, in fact, was a captain of the Regulators.
That's right. And when the South Carolina militia tried to bring him to justice, the leaders of the militia were just shocked that this white community essentially rallied around Gibson and forced the members of the militia to flee for their lives.
Daniel J. Sharfstein is my guest. He's associate professor of law at Vanderbilt University and author of the new book, The Invisible Line, Three American Families and the Secret Journey from Black to White. We'll resume our conversation in a moment and invite you to call us now to join it. You can get on the phone at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Associate Law Professor at Vanderbilt University, Daniel J. Sharfstein. His new book is called The Invisible Line, Three American Families and the Secret Journey from Black to White. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Daniel, going back to the story of the Gibsons, I guess because of their special status very early in the family's history, it was not an issue publicly for them to intermarry with white people?
Not that I can tell. There were only a couple of moments when it seemed that this was an issue for people in their neighborhood and people in the colony generally. After the regulator movement, the legislature debated whether a law called the Negro Act should apply to the Gibsons, and it was a law that allowed summary execution, essentially lynching, of rebellious African Americans. And the legislature debated it, and it never went anywhere. The Gibsons were off the hook because, in one legislator's words, they had more red and white in their faces than black. They were lighter than half the people who were in the South Carolina legislature. And they were so politically connected and powerful that it really didn't matter whether they were black or white. What mattered was that they were planters.
So a different family that took a very different course to this is the Spencers, who traced their roots back to rural Kentucky. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Sure. The Spencers became white in a small, isolated subsistence farming community in eastern Kentucky, what we refer to as an Appalachian mountain hollow. And they moved into this community before the Civil War. And Jordan Spencer, who was the patriarch of this large family, he had a white wife, and he had children who were all named after great Americans. There was James Madison, James Monroe, George Washington, Benjamin Franklin. He threw in Christopher Columbus. And he looked visibly different. He was dark, according to the testimony of people who had known him. He dyed his hair red, but it didn't fool anybody, because I guess the hair dye technology in the 1840s, 1850s was different from what it is today, and it ran every time that he sweat. And Jordan Spencer was a manual laborer and basically spent all his waking hours sweating. So people were constantly reminded that he was different. And at the same time, they said he was a hard worker, that he went to church, he sang loudly and sang well, and he was, in such a short order, such a valuable member of this community, that to insist that he was different and to enforce some kind of color line just didn't make sense in what was essentially a permanent frontier.
What sort of awareness do the modern-day descendants of these families have of their backgrounds?
That's a really interesting question. There has been a total range of responses to that when I've interviewed descendants. So some people said we had absolutely no idea. Some people, what they would say is they had absolutely no idea, but there were certain hints that maybe they did have an idea. So one of the descendants of the Spencers who I quote in the book, a woman named Frieda Spencer Goebel, she said that until she went into the public library in Johnson County, Kentucky, saw that the 1850 census was searchable on the internet, entered Jordan Spencer's name, and then called the librarian over to ask, what does M-U-L mean? The right by his name was the notation mulatto. She said she had no idea about the family history. But when she mentioned it to her mother said, your daddy would be rolling in his grave if he found this out. And Frieda asked why, and her mother said, because when he was growing up, every now and then someone would accuse him of being black, and that always meant in their mountain neighborhood a fist fight. So,
because it was considered an insult when he was growing up.
That's right.
Among white people.
Although at the same time, he essentially, this was the era of segregation, and he was, without a doubt, classified white. So this was something that could persist in community memory, but at the same time have no real effect on the family's larger status.
Did families who sort of teetered on this line between black and white, did they tend to be any more perhaps racist and anti-black than their neighbors who didn't have this history as a way of sort of justifying their righteous position within the white community as they saw it?
There certainly was every incentive not to attract unwelcome scrutiny. And so in a way, insisting that you were white did translate into insisting that you don't like black people.
Hmm.
So with all of these families, there were moments when the families had, when members of these families had to take some kind of stand on the race question, and they were capable of making very strong statements that they did not like black people. At the same time, there were moments, particularly with the Spencer family, where they could live their identity, for lack of a better word, they could wear their identity lightly. So with the Spencer family, there was a court case in 1914 where a Virginia court had to determine whether the Spencers were white or black. And there was testimony that one of the Spencers would hang out in the neighborhood with his buddies, and they would drink and talk. And one of the Spencers said that he was part black, but he didn't mind because it made him hardy. There were definitely moments when the Spencers had to draw the line and really strongly identify as white. But even in the Jim Crow South, people on a one-to-one basis could define race in different, more casual ways.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. My guest is Daniel J. Sharfstein, author of The Invisible Line, Three American Families and the Secret Journey from Black to White. We'll go to the phones now and speak with David in Nevada. Hi, David.
Hi, thank you for the interesting program.
Sure.
You know, morals and ethics evolve over time just as life does. And I hear a very common, in these kinds of commentaries, I hear a very common problem in that people tend to judge people of the 16th, 17th, and 18th, 19th century by the ethical and moral standards of the 21st century. We need to remember, if we want to get a really clear picture of people like the Gibsons and all that, that while we would find slavery and those kinds of things reprehensible today, during their time, this was considered usual and normal by the majority of people. And if we really want to understand them, we need to understand that this was not seen as an ethical problem by most people. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. What do you think about that, Daniel?
I think that raises a really interesting point. And it was very important to me as I wrote this book to tell the story really through the eyes of the participants, through the eyes of the members of these families. In a way, it's perfectly understandable that the Gibsons did not express any kind of regret or remorse or chagrin over how they were living their lives. At the same time, I think it's remarkable the extent to which people were capable of thinking about race in ways that are recognizable to us today. People were capable of even talking about how race was a social and legal fiction in ways that would make an ethnic studies professor in 2011 beam with pride. Yet at the same time, they could live these intense contradictions. So on one hand, it's absolutely important that we understand that morals and ethics change over time. At the same time, it's important to really take these people as we find them and give them credit for being very intelligent and capable of thinking through these issues.
I want to talk about the third family in the book here that in some ways it has the most fascinating story, at least to my mind. The Walls family, they were descended from a white plantation owner who never married but did impregnate several women that he kept in slavery.
Yes, and in a way, the Wall family's narrative is the one that we are most familiar with as Americans, the children of a slave owner and slaves. But then the slave owner, a man named Stephen R. Wall, was owned a very large plantation in along the North Carolina-South Carolina border. He did something that is a little less familiar to us. He freed his children and sent them to Ohio to be raised by radical Quaker abolitionists. He knew that this is what was going to happen to them. He actually funded their school, and his children became very active in the anti-slavery movement, very committed civil rights activists, and they moved from southern Ohio as they came of age to Oberlin, which in the years before the Civil War was pound for pound the most abolitionist town in America, and they were leaders of a thriving African-American community in Oberlin. And they participated in what was essentially the Underground Railroad. One person who I spend a lot of time following in the book, a man named Orondatus Simon Bolivar Wall. I think to everyone's relief, he called himself OSB Wall. He was indicted for violating the Fugitive Slave Act for taking part in a mass vigilante rescue of a captured fugitive slave. And he went on to recruit hundreds of soldiers for the Massachusetts 54th and for other black regiments. He then was commissioned a captain in the Union Army. He served in the Freedmen's Bureau. And then he moved to Washington, D.C. after the war and became part of this rising black political class. He entertained Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony at his home. He was a real leader in the district. He served in political office, was elected by a majority white district, and he raised his children to expect that they would have a full set of rights, just like any other American. And his children, they reached adulthood right at the end of Reconstruction, right when Jim Crow slammed the door on all of these possibilities and hopes and dreams. And his children, in the 1890s, in the 1900s, they decided to move away and establish themselves as whites.
And they did that in part by marrying white spouses, is that right?
Right. They married whites. They moved to places like New York and to Montreal. They also moved to new subdivisions in Washington, D.C., which were just being built, and they essentially, they were very light-skinned in a way. Before they became white, they had to insist on being black every day, whether it was with police officers or random people they met in the street or shopkeepers. This was something that they had to constantly think about. So becoming white was almost accomplished by just keeping their mouths shut.
And then one of the more disturbing outcomes of this is you profile a man who is alive today, Thomas Murphy, who's the great-grandson of OSB Wall. Not only was he, I guess, unaware of his family's African-American roots, he was widely considered by his black co-workers to be a vehement racist.
That's true. And then he had this very conflicted relationship with the people where he worked. And I think he didn't really think of himself as a racist at that moment. I think he was, in a way, caught up in a bad workplace dynamic. But then he learned about his ancestor, OSB Wall. And that's the moment, actually. It was really fascinating talking to him when he thought to himself, actually, I am a racist. And I trying to wrap my head around that, to me, I think he was so invested in maintaining his identity as a white person that to him, nothing made that point clearer than claiming to hate African Americans. But his reaction was much more complex than that. He said that the news made him more racist than ever, but at the same time, he couldn't stop researching the story. He was tireless about it, and he would publicly post everything that he was finding. In a way, he claimed to be completely uninvested, completely against this kind of revelation, but at the same time, this gave him an enormous purpose and an enormous sense of belonging, in a way. It connected him to great themes and great stories in American history.
Daniel J. Sharfstein is my guest. He's Associate Professor of Law at Vanderbilt University and author of the new book, The Invisible Line, Three American Families and the Secret Journey from Black to White. We'll resume our conversation with Daniel and take more of your calls after the break. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Daniel J. Sharfstein. He's the author of The Invisible Line, Three American Families and the Secret Journey from Black to White. Back to the phones now, and we will speak with Shirley in Fort Worth. Hi, Shirley.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
My comment and question for Dr. Sharfstein is my father was from Tennessee, Tullahoma, that area. And he lived to be 95 years old. And really, I didn't really, you know, explore too much of that part of the family until after he passed about 10 years ago, and discovered that his grandmother was a full-blooded Cherokee Native American, according to Ancestry.com, and his grandfather was a full-blooded Irishman. My father always disdained his European heritage. He was not proud of it. He married a lady who was dark-complected, who was not my mother, but her people were so light-complected that when I met them, I thought they were white.
Shirley, let me interrupt you for a second. Your father identified as black, as African-American?
Definitely.
Okay.
He married my mother, who was dark, because he did not like light-complected people.
Mm-hmm.
He disdained his European heritage. So he himself and his sisters and brothers were all raised as African-Americans. And his mother's sisters all married black men, even though you could not tell them from white. And they chose not to be considered black at all. So my question to Dr. Sharfstein is how much of, in his for in looking at this subject, did he find of Indians or Native Americans marrying Irishmen or and that being part of the mixed thing, or and how many situations did he find where even though these people were Christians, my father was a minister for many, many years and a Christian, how many of these white individuals who confessed to be Christians but yet had these prejudices against individuals because of skin color? And I just want to make this comment. Among black people today, there is prejudice against your people within your own group because of skin color or because of whatever. It still occurs within our group. So I would like for him to answer that question. I appreciate this very much.
Thanks for your call.
I think that Shirley's family history is remarkable, and it's also very typical. A lot of people have a lot of different complicated ancestry, and making sense of it really is an important part of understanding who they are. So Shirley had a question about Native Americans marrying whites, and I found a lot of history of Native Americans marrying whites and also Native Americans marrying African Americans. And in a way, this history of black and white and the way that people drew the color line had an enormous effect on the development and evolution of Native American tribes and Native American attitudes towards race. There in Virginia, for example, periodically there were calls to take back Native American land. This was in the colonial era into the 19th century because the Native Americans had been marrying too much into the African American community. And at those moments, Native Americans would purge their ranks of people who were too dark-skinned and make a case for not being black. And there's a legacy that we see even today with cases involving the Seminole Nation and other Native American tribes. And Shirley also talked about skin color prejudices within the African American community. And this is very much a legacy of this larger history of black and white and discrimination by race.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to North Richland Hills and speak with Suzanne. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, how are y'all doing?
Great, thanks.
I had a comment for Mr. Sharfstein. Something from what y'all were talking about earlier on different state laws of who is considered legally black or white. Concerning President Obama, my father-in-law made an interesting comment of, you know, why do we call President Obama black when he's just as equally white? And I know there's political motivations there, but I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about our modern views on classifying race and how people look versus, you know, their actual ancestry.
Thanks for your call. And Daniel, before you answer Suzanne, there are no state laws anymore that classify people's race. Is that correct?
The basic rule is people self-identify now. I think the last set of rules that people litigated over was a law in Louisiana, and there was a lawsuit in the mid-1980s.
And as to the question of President Obama, he has self-identified as African-American.
And that we've had 2 years plus, really, 3 years of running commentary on President Obama's race. And it's really ranged from President Obama being too black to President Obama being not black enough. And then there's this middle position that he is equally black and equally white. In history, there were if President Obama made a whistle-stop tour across the United States, his racial status would change from one state to another. Nowadays, I think about this in terms of a metaphor to naturalization. President Obama, his race is entirely up to him on one level, but at the same time, his race is determined by how we respond to him and how we classify him. I mean, it's a really interesting lesson on what race is. You know, is it your self-identity, or is it how other people view you? And this is a question that also clearly goes to the stories that have been written recently about the multiracial categories in the U.S. Census.
Do you think it's possible that in our future people will be able to entirely determine how they identify themselves and not have that affected by what other people assume them to be?
It's really interesting. We live in an age that's supposedly post-racial, and at the same time, race remains this really potent dividing line and political tool. I think that if we wind up in a society where a lot of the external measurements of racial discrimination, the persistence of housing segregation, the persistent income gap, the persistent wealth gap, if these major markers of discrimination fade away, then I think the questions of identity also will begin to become more complicated and also less powerful.
We have an email here from Ms. Newton who wants to know, how did you find Living Descendants and how long did it take you for you to complete this book?
That's a great question. So this is a book that maybe either couldn't have been written or would have taken a much, much longer time to write, even 10 years ago. And in recent years, there's been just a huge revolution in historical research technologies. There is so much genealogical material that is posted on the internet and searchable. And we also have DNA technologies where people swab their cheek and send it off to a lab, and then they get the results back in a couple weeks. And then people discuss it online. So finding living descendants was a genealogical project, which took me less time than I thought it would because of what was available on the computers. At the same time, this was a story that took me many years to write. I really started working on it in earnest in the fall of 2004. And even before that, this is something that I had been thinking about for many, many years. I would date it back to the summer of 1993 when I was still in college. I worked with someone on a voter education project in South Africa who said she should have been classified by the government as African, which was the apartheid-era designation for black, but she was designated colored. And the reason why was decades earlier, an apartheid official went door-to-door classifying people, and he knew her father, who was a police officer, thought he'd do him a favor and put a C by their names instead of an A. And it had a huge effect, this one word, this one letter, on her life. We think of race as obvious or inevitable, but that really showed me that it could be a product of personal relationships and community dynamics and even individual whim. And I came back to the United States wondering if it could happen here.
And just to clarify for people, in South Africa at that time, the designation colored meant mixed race, which was considered somehow to be better than full-blooded African.
That's right. And to have a C by your name instead of an A meant you lived in a different kind of a township, went to a different kind of school, lived in a different kind of house, only spoke English and Afrikaans as opposed to an African language. It had a very big effect on how people lived their lives and thought about their world.
We have time to take one more call. Let's speak with Tina in Dallas. Hi, Tina.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just have two quick comments. First, I wanted to comment on the caller who called in earlier about the ethics and morals of 17th, 18th, 19th century, almost slavery-type conditions. I wanted to say that they were immoral and reprehensible and unethical then, and they are the same now. So even though it may have been the norm, it was still a reprehensible condition to have to live in. The other piece I wanted to talk about and ask the caller is, do you think or would you agree that today African Americans are still shifting and transitioning to that invisible line so that we more easily assimilate into corporate America, especially where it's predominantly white cultures and leadership? For example, African-American women who straighten their hair because you can't go in with your natural hair or you're seen as some type of radical, or you take on styles of clothing and dress that might not come naturally to you, but that are more easily acceptable and that your white counterparts are not intimidated or in fear. You are, tend to articulate your speech more. You have the education, the advanced degree. So in essence, as African Americans, we're still transitioning and trying to take on more of the characteristics of our white counterparts, maybe not physically in terms of skin, but we still make those shifts and transitions each day we walk out of our door. And I'll listen to your response.
Thanks for your call.
Tina raises two really interesting points. First, she says that slave owners are immoral and reprehensible today and were immoral and reprehensible then. And I think when you look at the historical material, one, there was all kinds of dissent and dispute and debate over slavery. So it was absolutely not within, or it was absolutely within the realm of their everyday lives to think about the morals of what they were doing.
By the way, Daniel, we have about 15 seconds left.
Oh, great. And they often talked about slaves being treated badly, too. In terms of assimilating today, there is absolutely a process where people are having to conform to what will bring them a better livelihood and better lives for them and their children.
Daniel J. Sharfstein's new book is called The Invisible Line, Three American Families and the Secret Journey from Black to White. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.